The aunt of one of the first complainants in the Peter Alice sex abuse case remains convinced Alice is guilty and says continuing to drag the case through the courts is further victimising the former Crace children further. In 1993, Alice was sentenced to 10 years for jail for abusing 7 children at the Christchurch Civic Crèche, but he has always maintained his innocence. Recently diagnosed with terminal cancer, he's now taking the fight to clear his name to the Supreme Court. The original convictions were based on preschoolers' testimony of ritual abuse and torture. Now, 3 convictions were overturned in 1994 after one of the children said she lied. Checkpoint has repeatedly asked Peter Alice through his lawyer for an interview. He has declined to be interviewed, but his appeal will focus on whether the children's evidence is reliable. The aunt, who we can't name for legal reasons, now works in the legal profession herself. The child in her family was interviewed by the police, but was not one of the 7 who Alice was convicted of abusing. I started by asking her why she is speaking out now.
There's been a very one-dimensional analysis of the case and a false story spun. And parents and whānau are, by nature of the case, committed to the privacy and rights of their children, cannot respond. So we never have. We've let the law talk for us. And the result is there's been a whole lot of other talk that's left to go unchallenged and a completely bizarre story made up as if it's fact in the public domain.
Well, let's work our way through some of this, starting with the really primary core question. Could Peter Alice be innocent?
No. I've asked myself this from the beginning and every year since, and as I've done legal training and as I've seen other cases, and throughout, and no, he can't, because there can only be 2 possibilities. Children were harmed or they were not. For it to be not that they weren't harmed, there must be another plausible reason for all the evidence. And the adults created it for whatever reason is the only possible one, and we've been given what seems to be a plausible story of how that happened. But I was there. I know that story is wrong in very key particulars, so I know that's not plausible. So you take that away, what have you got?
So you have no doubt in your mind that Peter Alice is guilty?
I have no doubt, because for the reasons I've stated, because I've heard firsthand disclosures from children, and because I know that the alternative to the children being right is not right.
There is obviously going to be an appeal to the Supreme Court, and it largely is going to centre around, as we understand it, the children's evidence and the allegation that that evidence is in some way contaminated or was improperly obtained, right? So those are valid concerns, aren't they, that should be tested?
I'm interested in how the Supreme Court has the ability to order it, because this case occurred before 2002, which is when the Supreme Court gained jurisdiction. These things have been looked at. This case, it's just as hard in 1992-95 to get a conviction on any sexual abuse offence as it is now. It's extremely, extremely difficult to get it on the evidence of small children, so there has to be a great consistency and amount of evidence. That's the same then as it would be again now. For people, for legal commentators particularly, to think that it was possible for parents to just rock up to court and make any old crazy accusation, and that it would survive through a trial, depositions, because a lot of commentators didn't come until after this, depositions, a trial, 2 appeals, which is unique. The evidence was overwhelmingly upheld throughout this process, and then a judicial inquiry, which found that the possibility of Peter being innocent was non-existent virtually. That they said the appeal failed by a long shot. And it said that people who had heard all the evidence knew that, and that is the case. So people have just taken a stance over the coffee cups, as it were, and because it has invested a lot, I've got to say, academic and legal careers in a certain version. And I actually don't know how this would have played out without that. But people took had a reason from very early on with their careers academically for taking a stance that they've really held on to and gathered associates around, because there's been absolutely nothing in the media, because there can't be. The parents and children remain silent. We've now created something that is so unsafe in New Zealand that none of the child victims could possibly come forward now without fearing being held down.
The last time this case was reviewed is in about 2001, which was the judicial inquiry.
Yes.
Isn't it conceivable that what we know about evidence and the way we interview children has changed since then, and that we now have information that may call into question the testimony of those children?
To do so is to accept that every sexual abuse conviction gained under that methodology is now unsafe and could be overturned. Now, that's a retrospective, it doesn't usually apply in law, retrospective wisdom. At the time, it was best practice. It has, the reasons for people suspecting it aren't reasons, because they're not real. This is my problem. You know, the people that are suspecting the evidence is to fit with the scenario, which, again, I say, they've hinged a lot of personal and academic and coffee cup attachment to, because it's never been challenged. Whole careers have been built on this, and they're missing the central point, is why. Why would this evidence be there? Why would the consistency be there?
So interviews with the children, some of the children mentioned things like tunnels and dungeons and hanging in cages. Really, well, fantastic stuff in some people's minds. Don't you have concerns about any of that?
Look, no, I what I see is that the evidence stood on the consistencies. Now, these were very young children. They're from different cultures, different family backgrounds. They were, if you take any group of 100 people and dump them in a situation like this, they're going to respond differently to their child's distress, to their child's disclosures. Those kids will have been reading and watching and hearing different things. There's various reasons for that. But however, I honestly think the whole satanic ritual abuse thing is just a red herring for what we now know is this widespread child pornography. Mainly, you've got to realise that this was in the background of the 1990s. This was the reason this howl set up was because people couldn't believe it could happen. Well, in those days, we didn't have Jimmy Savile and Rolf Harris and Bill Cosby and all of that. Now, if we think that it only occurs in entertainment, well, that's wrong, isn't it? We've got huge cases overseas, New South Wales, Northern England and so on like that, where there was standard different styles of dress-ups, child pornography, well and truly established, and I think that's really what we've got the case of here. I think that's led to some of these so-called bizarre claims. What's not bizarre is the consistency amongst the children.
So you believe the core accusations of the children?
The core accusations that they were taken and harmed, and that, that took different forms.
But do you accept that there could be some fantasy elements injected into the evidence as well, a combination of truth and stories?
I believe they could have been told certain things, that certain people were present and that kind of stuff, of course.
Okay.
That we can't test, but we can test the consistency between and the collaboration between accounts.
This was the early 90s. Could it be that Peter Ellis was the victim of prejudice and homophobia at the time?
Yes, that's something that really upsets families, and it seriously bothers me. This is completely untrue. This was the woke liberal creche from Christchurch. Everybody there was warmly supportive of the complainants' families themselves. Many of them were friends of Peter's. He was warmly supported in his identity. To a degree, where it's quite bizarre when we look back now. But it is completely untrue. There was nothing like that. This is not conservative white Christchurch being shocked at someone who's a bit out there. This was liberal Christchurch being delighted by someone who was a bit out there, and as a result, probably didn't see things sooner.
Okay, so three of his convictions were overturned in around 1994 after one of the complainants said that she had made evidence up, withdrew her evidence in essence. Does that not have implications for the evidence of the other children?
Look, the retracting child, that just means that eight became seven in the case. That child's evidence was then not considered. It's another demonstration of how the scales of judgment in this case have just got weighted when only one side has got freedom of speech. It's become accepted somehow that one retraction out of eight, under who knows, we don't know what adult pressure, means that other children's evidence, all the other children's consistent, corroborated evidence is unsafe. Well, that's ridiculous. It's seven against. So what it is normal in any group of children that will happen, and we can see that around the world. The other children's evidence is not invalidated, or it's still considered on its own merits and was examined and upheld. And if you step back, is it not the logical thing that if the retraction was the true story, there would have been either a flood or a trickle of retractions over the years? Remember, 50 kids or plus gave. These kids, the court kids, were 77 kids representing concerning interviews over many, many, many more children that didn't meet the three interview consistency requirement to be a court child or their parents. Some did, actually. Quite a few did, and their parents didn't want to put them through the ordeal. Everyone's thinking all those kids made everything up and all those families did that to their kids on purpose, which is just, is that not more bizarre?
So you don't believe that one person withdrawing their evidence affects the remaining evidence of the other children?
No, I don't. I think going through the court process for those children was extremely grueling, and the fact that seven had the courage and the support to go through with it is the incredible thing. I think that it hadn't dropped out to three or four by the time we got to the second appeal is the remarkable thing, because it took such stamina. I tell you, for those families that were there being denigrated and outright lied about again and again in the media, with no chance, as I say, no, freedom of speech has this entire time been entirely one-sided. You must see that in the media. You must know that if you don't front with your story, then another story gets told, and that's what's happened.
So what did
we
you have?
Left it to the justice system to speak our truth, and it did. It did an amazing job. It gave me faith in the justice system. And what it did was it taught me a valuable life lesson, which is, unless I know, I don't know. I don't pretend to know what is or isn't the case of something that's in the media unless I really know.
So what did you have to do with the other children in this case, if anything?
I had friends whose children went there and whose disclosures I heard. And my children, one of my children was enrolled to start there but hadn't started by the time this happened.
So did you over the years speak to those other children?
Yes.
About what had happened?
Yes, I did. I was in the room with one of the children when they read out the single question that they was recommended at the public meeting that followed the City Council called public meeting where they were beginning to question children. I was in the room when that one friend's child was read that out, and there was a very strong and disturbing reaction. And I subsequently heard disclosures from that child unprompted out of the blue, middle of the night.
Because you will be aware, one of the issues is that parents were asking their children questions when they'd been advised not to, and there are serious concerns about contamination of the evidence. So did you ever ask any of the kids questions?
No, definitely not. Not beyond that card ever. And my response to that is, again, you get 100 people in any situation and you'll get a variety of responses. Some parents were just incredible and restrained and professional and went out of the room to cry and do nothing to prompt it. Other parents, of course, probably did question their kids more because everyone's going to be different. How do you expect, if your kid's sitting there telling you these things, how are you not going to say who was there? But a lot of people didn't. A lot of people did really well. It was really complicated. That's why it got down to 8 kids at trial, and that's why it got down, as I say, not surprising to me that it got down to 7 under the kind of pressure families were under.
So what is it like for your family after all of these years, so many years, for this to still be going through the courts?
Oh yeah, look, this really churns my stomach, and it churns my stomach for the victims, you know, and for the, we've all got on, but it's cost us all dearly. It's affected our relationships, how close we are, can live to each other, the course our life's taken, all sorts of things, our responses in lots of situations. Me in the legal profession now, I just come up against it all the time. And I just want to shake people and say, hey, you should know better. You should be able to stand back and realise that when a story is told one-sidedly or when you take significant factors out, this needs looking at. And, it is really sickening that it's come up now. I actually am a strong believer in the justice system because of how it served us, and part of that is I'm a strong believer that you go to court, you get the court decides, you get your sentence, you do your sentence, and that's the end of it. And that's how I would have liked it to have been for this. I actually, you know, I have no ill will to any, to Alice himself, and I'm not going to say I'm sorry he's sick. It's just irrelevant, but he did his time, good as gold. But what's different about Alice is all of these people who invested so much, who had voice and power early on, that invested so much in a story they wanted to believe that made them feel better about what had happened.
But as someone who works in the legal profession, you must accept that there are cases where there are wrongful convictions.
I do. That's why I keep a really open mind about what I do and don't know.
This could be one of them, couldn't it?
We've got some spectacular ones in New Zealand, and I've got some opinions on some of them and absolutely no opinions on others because I don't know enough unless I knew enough. And I don't think anyone that's commenting on this case publicly knows enough to be commenting on it. And almost everybody knows nothing, but even the ones that have been following it, the journalists and so on. So, yeah, no, right. You're absolutely right. I find it fascinating that that I'm in this position, this close to it. And I'm a great believer in the justice system and finding out where it hasn't been upheld. It's just, this isn't one of them.
He's dying now, Peter Alice, and has got limited time left. He's served his jail sentence. Why would he be pursuing it so vigorously, do you think?
You'll have to ask him. I can only express my private opinion that it's got as much to do with the people around him's investment. There is always another side. And what I think is really interesting in this case is it was about a city possessed. We've become a country possessed. But it's on the other side. There's been a witch hunt, but it's been against families and victims.
And that was the aunt of one of the first complainants in the Peter Alice sex abuse case. And Peter Alice declined to be interviewed.